I take my text tonight from E.M. Forster, his little motto, the two-word motto, only connect, which of course means if only one sees connections between things that seem rather dissimilar and recognizes the surprising similarity between them or the way that they converge and prompt new ideas, one in that way gets enlightenment, especially for a problem that one might have facing one at just that moment. And the two things that I want to only connect tonight are the idea of the civil ethic of a civil community, and I shall define these terms in a moment, on the one hand, and on the other hand, individual health. Because after all, a community's health profile is the sum of individual health in that community, and it matters that when one becomes practically minded and tries to put things into concrete effect, that concrete effect should be present in the individual and in the individual life. And so this idea of a good community, a community which is flourishing and which expresses all the best and highest ideals or the best approximations to those ideals for a good community, that idea I want to relate to the idea of individual health. And I want to do it by looking at some admittedly utopian conceptions of these things that we've inherited in our Western tradition of thought. The point there being that if one sees what the utopian ideal is, one can try to imagine ways of getting as close as one can to it in practical application. And this is not such a far-fetched enterprise as one might think for two reasons. Firstly, one of the founding documents of Western thought is, of course, that great work by Plato, The Republic. Footnote, an idea about the good society that we hope never to see realized in practice, because it is so fascist in its nature, of course. But it in the process of developing his ideas, Plato had so many interesting things to say that it's as well to exploit them in our own thinking about the good society, too. But in that document, Plato draws a direct analogy between the health of an individual and the health of a civil community. And although what I would like to suggest in what I'll say this evening is something more direct than an analogy, than merely an analogy, nevertheless, there are some features of the analogy that Plato draws that I think are well worth exploiting. So I shall come back to that in a moment and talk about that in a little detail. But the other reason why it's not so far-fetched to try to put the idea of a civil community into connection with the idea of individual health is that we're already familiar with some aspects of the way that community structure and community character can affect individual health. We're very, very familiar indeed with all those socioeconomic reasons why health in a community can be good or bad. And the most familiar example, of course, is that in situations where there are high levels of poverty and low levels of education, levels of health tend to be very poor. If you look, for example, at the experience, familiar, I'm sure, to all of you, of the relation between education and infant mortality and size of family in the third world, one sees that very modest amounts of education, just 2 years of elementary education, can have an enormous impact on things like family size and child mortality, general family health, and also on incidence of HIV. One sees also in third world countries, and especially in Africa, that in those communities where women are able to own property, incidence of HIV/AIDS is very much lower than in those communities where women can't own property but are themselves property and have no choice about what happens to them in the family setting. So in those very obvious and direct ways, we know that socioeconomic conditions have an immediate impact on community health and therefore on individual health. But the obverse of that thought, that there are other aspects of the community which can have a bearing, sometimes direct and sometimes indirect, on the health of people in that community, that point is not often enough made, and it's that point that I want to make here. So let me begin with a definition of what I mean by a civil community. What I mean by it, in essence, is the polis. That's not the boys in blue, by the way. This is the Greek conception of a fairly a relatively small, integrated, self-aware community of people. Now, I think the closest thing that might come to that would be a city, and perhaps not even a very large city. Perhaps if you have a very large city like, say, London or Moscow, or Los Angeles, you might have to think of areas of the city or aspects of the city. In the case of London, which is my own home now, I'm very conscious of the fact that there are very well-defined differences between different communities. They may not be geographical communities, but they're definitely sociological ones. Now, there are at least two, and probably three or four, definitely definable different communities in London, and they each of them invite consideration in different ways and present different problems. So by the idea of a civil community, I mean something notional rather than concrete or geographical, but nevertheless something quite definite, even though notional. And this is the idea of something which in the contemporary world might reflect or iterate the idea of the polis as the Greeks conceived it in classical antiquity. So civil community or polis. And my thought is that there are some things that one can think about the nature of the good civil community, the flourishing, successful civil community, and its relation to the well-being and flourishing of its individual members, which are very significant and worth exploring, and which offer some suggestions, some lessons, again, sometimes direct and sometimes indirect, for how the enhancement of the character, the quality of the civil community can have an effect on individual health in that community. And in order to creep up on this from behind, because what one needs to do is to put into place some pieces of the jigsaw puzzle here to get a feeling for what one's trying to articulate. In order to do that, I'd just like to follow the advice of Ludwig Wittgenstein, footnote, one always has to mention him in a philosophy lecture, end footnote, which was to assemble some reminders, to remind ourselves of some things that we know so that we can make use of them and focus them on our problem. And I do that by talking about how in classical antiquity, when serious theorizing about the good society and about the best arrangement for people to live together really began. And it began, as it were, from first principles. And it began in, again, as it were, virgin territory, where people were thinking about the right conditions for the good civil society quite afresh. There wasn't all that much baggage, but at least not of the kind that we now have when we think about different political arrangements, different economic arrangements, different experiments failed and otherwise that we in the Western tradition have witnessed over the centuries in trying to forge successful societies. But for the Greeks, especially the Athenians of the era of Pericles and Solon and Pisistratus and of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, that there was relatively fresh material for thinking about what the good life is and what the good setting for the good life is. And the moment of transition from a quite different way of conceiving how society should be and should operate, a transition from an older, an archaic way of thinking about that to the classical conception, which is our source, our resource now for thinking about these things, is wonderfully captured in one of Aeschylus's plays, in the third of the Oresteia trilogy. I'll just remind you of this sad story, the sort of terrific ancient Greek soap opera, really, when you remember how it all worked out. You remember Helen and Paris, and off they went to Troy, and then as a result, Menelaus' complaint to his brother Agamemnon, king of all the kings in the antique world, got the flotilla of 1,000 ships launched. Footnote, the fact that Helen was beautiful enough to launch 1,000 ships suggests a sort of aesthetic metric. A milli-Helen would be just enough beauty to launch, so it might be one ship. The usual. But and the fleet was just about to set off to Troy, you remember, but there was a wind preventing them. They just couldn't set sail. And of course, with so many soldiers in so many ships and the victuals being eaten and the weapons getting rusty and people getting fed up and so on, the whole enterprise would have failed had they not been able to set off. And then the soothsayers told Agamemnon that somebody had killed one of their birds sacred to Diana, and that was why she had set a prevailing wind against them, and so they had to make a great sacrifice. And this is a very interesting point, by the way. I'm just going to register this point about the great sacrifices that were made by whole communities of people in the ancient world. You've heard of the idea of the hecatomb, the 100 oxen that are tremendous amount of wealth if you think about it, 100 oxen that a community might slaughter and sacrifice to the gods if they were going to do some great thing or they needed the gods' favor. Well, the great sacrifice that had to be made by the 1,000 ships was the sacrifice of Iphigenia, Agamemnon's daughter. And once she had been killed, the wind changed and the armada could sail to Troy, and there followed, you know, the 10 Years' War and the rest. And when Agamemnon got home, his wife, Clytemnestra, was understandably annoyed about what had happened to their daughter, and they didn't quite see that it was necessary to go to Troy and have the war at all. And so she, in her irritation with her husband, killed him. And their son Orestes was therefore bound by the laws of revenge to kill his mother to avenge his father, which he did. Whereupon the Erinyes, the Furies, the old gods whose task it was to pursue and punish those who had committed parenticide of one form or another, set off after Orestes, and he was chased from pillar to post around the Greek world until finally ended up at Delphi. Story doesn't go on much longer, folks. And he asks Apollo for his help, advice. And Apollo says, go to Athens and ask my sister Athene for her advice, and she'll help you. So he does that. And what Athene does is she assembles a jury of Athenian citizens, 1,000 of them. She summons them to the Areopagus, the hill of Mars in Athens. And she puts to them what had happened to Orestes and asks them to decide on his guilt. Orestes, and rather fortunately, has Apollo as his defense lawyer. That's the good news. The bad news is that the argument that Apollo gave, absolutely appalling one. He said, Orestes didn't kill a parent because a mother isn't a parent, she's only a receptacle. The real parent is the father, and he was avenging his father, so he had done right, and so on. He managed to persuade 500 of the 1,000 who voted for his innocence that Athene used her casting vote to let Orestes free. So after many bounds, Orestes was free. And the Furies, as was their wont, were furious. They said to Athene, you young gods, you've usurped our role. It's our task to punish people who do these sorts of things. And here you are, assembling a jury of citizens and discussing it and coming to a conclusion and having a vote and letting Orestes off. That's not the way that, you know, we've done it in the past. In the past, we've just taken revenge, and that was our job. And Athene says to them, this is a new world. This is a world where we gather together and discuss things and decide on what's best for us. And what's best for us is what we will agree on. We try to seek for a consensus, and we try to live together in this community on the basis of that consensus. And that's why this has happened. That's why I've summoned this jury. And from now on, that is how we will govern ourselves in my city. The people, the men, of course, age 30 and over, will meet in the agora, and they will discuss things, and they will take a vote. But you, the Furies, since your job has now been, you know, since you're redundant in effect, why don't you stay here in Athens with us, and we will always give you nice sacrifices and so on, and you can look kindly upon us, and we will change your name from the Erinyes to the Eumenides, to the kindly ones. Now that play captures this signal moment in the history of the Western tradition. Because prior to this idea of a civic community that discusses things and tries to reach consensus, and in which the citizens, admittedly only the 30 and older year old men were citizens in the full sense, but at least the concept of a citizen democracy, of discussion and debate, of a conversation that the society has with itself about how it will conduct itself and what the best is for it. That moment is captured there by Aeschylus in conscious opposition to what had been the case before. And what had been the case before was that the good person was the person who, firstly, was male, secondly, was strong enough, brave enough, had enough endurance, courage, fortitude, and muscle to wield a sword or a spear and to defend his community against the invader and the enemy. And the idea of the warrior virtues, of the warrior society, remained, of course, in Sparta for a long time after Athens had become a civilian polis. And there's this very, very sharp contrast between the two of them. And as you would expect, as happened in the Peloponnesian War, when they went to war with one another, Sparta won. That was because it had retained these military virtues. And the very word virtue, itself, although of Latin origin, as you know, the first syllable, vir, means male. It doesn't mean man in the generic sense of human being, but it means male, fortitude, endurance, strength, the ferocity needed for battle. and that the very earliest conception of virtue, of masculinity, is therefore reflective of this older dispensation of things, where in a dangerous and uncertain world, the only thing that provided you with any kind of protection was your own strong right arm. And the change from that to a situation where cooperation, discussion, preparedness to go along with the majority when you disagree, you know, imagine Athenian fox hunters. I mean, they wouldn't have been quite as upset as our own fox hunters are today, because they would have said, well, the contract that we have with one another here is that we work by consensus, and we seek agreement, and we abide by it, because we recognize all the benefits that we get from being a member of this community. And we recognize that the community can't function without cooperation, without a division of labor premised on trust, that is, that other people will do their part of the divided labor, and which above all is premised on this idea of the social or civil conversation, the conversation we have with ourselves about what's right and what we should do. And so there you have this turning point, captured, pinpointed, like a butterfly with a pin through it, in that play by Aeschylus. It's very powerful moment. And of course it generates all sorts of ideas, all sorts of resonances are set up by it. And it's therefore no surprise at all that very, very shortly after this, we should find people like Plato thinking hard about the nature of the good society and trying to argue. As so often happens in philosophical discussion of these matters, very shortly after the fact. I mean, in the case of ancient Athens, the great lawgiver Solon and Pericles, the great leader of Athens, had been setting down laws and structures and institutions which embodied and expressed this new civilian ideal for the community. And the philosophers, seeing what the rulers were doing, were commenting and criticizing and debating with one another about different options, different interpretations of how this might best work. A much more recent parallel, of course, is John Locke writing the two treatises of government after the Glorious Revolution of 1688, after the sovereignty of Parliament had been asserted in the deposing and selection of a new monarch. And the writings of John Locke on this topic are quoted in extenso and verbatim in the documents of the American War of Independence and the French Revolution. And there you see theory superinducing on practice, theory providing an understanding, an insight into what was actually happening in the shifts and changes in social structure and civil structure. Well, so you find this with Plato. And as I said earlier on, you find him doing it in a way which is very, very interesting, because he tries to describe his conception of the good society, of how a society ought to be organized, by analogy with health in an individual human being. And of course, the key concept which is distinctive of the classical outlook, and you find it in the architecture, the art, the enjoyment of just being embodied, being physical, being an athlete in the world, and in theory about the good society for the ancient Greeks, for the classical Greeks, was the concept of harmony or balance. And so the right structure for a state, said Plato, is one in which the three orders of men are in balance, in harmony with one another, that there is a due proportion, a proper proportionality between them in their responsibilities and roles, and in the exercise of those responsibilities. Just as in a human individual, the balance, the right balance of the humors is what makes the individual healthy, where, remember, healthy means whole, integrated, in accord with itself. So the society will be healthy, balanced, integrated, in accord with itself, if it has the right arrangement between the different orders of citizens. And you will remember, and of course, philosophers have a tendency to quite like the suggestion that Plato made, because the society would be run by philosophers, the philosopher kings. The downside of that is that they weren't to marry or have any private property. And then there were going to be the guardians, who were the brave and bold physically strong ones who would protect the society. There'd be the military arm. And then there would be hoi polloi. There would be everybody else who would trade and make and grow and sell and generally serve the others. And it would be rather, as I described it earlier on, rather a fascist society, because you know, the guardians would go around picking out the handsome youths and beautiful maidens and pair them up, and they would be able to breed. And when the babies were born, they would be taken into care, into state nurseries, where they would be bred up. And the ones that were big and strong would be made guardians, and the smart would become philosopher kings, and the ones who weren't either would become members of the hoi polloi. And that's how the society would organise itself. And what it reminds me of, by the way, is, have you ever come across the writings of Uspensky, the great disciple of Gurdjieff? Well, you've done very well not to, but Uspensky came up with this wonderful theory, which was that the most intelligent creatures that had ever existed on the planet were the ants. And they were so clever that they constructed a social organization, and they deliberately evolved themselves into a size and shape so that their power-weight ratio was greater than any other creature on the planet. And then they recognized that intelligence and creativity would disturb the beautiful intricacy of their social structure, so they evolved it out. And that's why they are as they are now, perfectly functioning society, perfect sort of weight and size and everything else, and relating to one another terribly well. But of course, no E.T. or Shakespeare or anything like that. Plato's idea suggests itself to me as being rather similar to Uspensky's idea of the ants, because here you have this perfectly balanced and structured society in which, and this is the only good thing, the philosophers decide everything, and it all works beautifully. But then you think to yourself, well, in such a society, where would there be room for novelty, for innovation, for change? Such a society would be very good at managing itself, but management, as you know, is premised on the status quo. And new things happening, or new challenges, new threats, or whatever it might be, how would it respond to those? How would it develop? And much more to the point, how would it exploit the individual talents and genius and creativity of its people? And of course, that's one of the things that one must make space for in a really flourishing civil community, because stasis means decay and ultimate collapse. And so a too perfect society, one which was too harmoniously balanced as Plato conceived it, would perhaps be self-defeating in the end. But at least it gives us this idea, the idea of a really well-structured, well-organized and well-run society. And the content of the idea that Plato offers us is one that we can react to and say why we don't like it and why we don't think it would work. So it provides us with a wonderful starting point. Now, you notice that the relation between the good society, as Plato had envisaged it, and the healthy individual is only an analogy. But the analogy trades on this idea of harmony or balance, which, as I say, is the key notion of the antique aesthetic. If you look at a Greek building, what it expresses is balance and proportion and harmony and symmetry. If you look at a statue of a Greek youth or a Greek maiden, you see there again harmony and balance and proportion. The celebration of these virtues, of these symmetries of the eye, and symmetries in thought, symmetries of a conceptual kind as well, were central to the Greek aesthetic. It amuses me, therefore, by the way, to note how the very intimate connection between aesthetics and ethics in the Greek view has worked its way through into this conception. Because those of you who have been to the British Museum will notice that the quite large collection of male nude Greek statues in the British Museum are all missing a rather significant bit. And those significant bits were all chipped off by the curators in the 19th century who thought they would offend the ladies who came to visit. And what they'd forgotten was that the reason why those strapping great athletes had really rather tiny little significant bits was because the size of them was meant to represent continence and chastity. You know, in depictions of Priapus and Bacchus and their followers and what have you, the significant bits are to take up most of the picture. Not to suggest that they were really so, but to imply incontinence and lust and the rest of it. So size matters, so to speak, ethically, because it tells you something about what the meaning of it is. So here were the curators of the British Museum chipping off the symbols of continence and chastity, and if only they had known, they would have left them on. What difference it would have made if they left them on, I don't know, but apparently they're all together in a drawer. And one day, somebody's going to have the entertaining task of trying to fit them to the original statues, with super glue, I suppose. Anyway, there you have an interesting development, really, because you've got your idea of proportion, symmetry, and harmony, but yet you modify the size of things or the proportions of things in order to say something ethical too. And this is very significant. In Plato and in his conception of the ideal polis, you've got the use of this aesthetic notion of balance, proportion, and harmony, and the analogy between the state and the individual member of the state. In Aristotle, you get an interesting development of this idea, an evolution of it. The proportional balance is a quality, a property of a way of thinking and a way of behaving in the ethical individual. The idea of Aristotle's virtuous individual, as you will know from your reading of it, is the person who always follows the mean, the middle path, in a situation of dilemma. So there is no set of rules or prescriptions in advance. There's no code. There's no Ten Commandments. There's no thou shalt or thou shalt not. There is just the virtue of practical wisdom, of finding yourself in a situation where you have to make a decision, and so you look at the circumstances and you try to steer the middle path in those circumstances. And thus the virtues. So cowardice and rashness are flank courage. Courage is the mean between cowardice and rashness. Generosity is the mean between profligacy and meanness, and so on for all the other virtues. They can all be identified as being the middle path between opposing vices. And so balance and proportion and harmony is the balance between opposing vices. It's the middle way. It's the person who uses practical wisdom. And Aristotle says, if you yourself don't have very much practical wisdom, then model yourself on the person who does. And in any case, if you do that, and this is something that you might encourage some younger people to do, to model themselves on virtuous older people, is that they will learn how to be virtuous. That ethics is being ethical is a process, and you could become better at it, and something you can devote your life to. And there's something really, by the way, significant about that, the point about it being ethics that you can become better at, which I'll mention in a moment. But this point that Aristotle was making harks back, of course, to a great problem that had been faced by Plato in his own ethical writings. And that was that in the Athens of the day, in this striving and debating and discussion about the best society, one thing that really worried people was that you got upstanding citizens, virtuous citizens, who had teenage children, who behaved frightfully badly. They stole chariots and did wheelies up and down the walls of Athens and got drunk and, you know, didn't water the wine and that kind of thing. You know, plus ça change. And how were they going to cope with this? And why wasn't it the case that virtuous people could pass on their virtue and their grasp of virtue to their offspring, to the next generation? I mean, those of you who know the dialogue Meno by Plato will remember that the rich young man Meno comes to Athens on business and in the evening goes, as so many visitors did, to see Socrates. You know, Socrates is a bit of a tourist industry, to engage him in conversation. And since Meno is very handsome, Socrates is perfectly happy to do that. And Meno asks him the question. He says, Socrates, this great question that we face in our present-day society, is virtue teachable? What is the answer to that? And Socrates said, I don't know. Meno was amazed. You, the great Socrates, you don't know the answer to that central question of our times. Why not? And Socrates said, because I don't know the answer to a prior question, which is, what virtue is? Said Meno. It's aghast. You don't know what virtue is? I mean, it was sort of unthinkable that people, anybody should not know what virtue is. Socrates said, no, I don't. Do you? Meno said, well, of course I do. And Socrates said, thank God, I've met somebody who knows what virtue is. Tell me. So Meno gives him a definition to which Socrates says, no, can't be that. And he tells him why it can't be that. And so Meno says, in that case, it's... And then he gives him another definition. And Socrates says, no, can't be that either. He explains why. And Meno says, and then he tries another definition. And Socrates says, no, can't be that either. Again, he explains. And Meno says, Socrates, you're like a wasp who stung my lips and tongue. I don't know what to say. I'm all confused. And Socrates says, good, now that you know that you don't know what you're talking about, we can begin to make progress. Because confusion is the beginning of wisdom. This is a story I tell all my students, you see, because they're in the first year. You know. But there is this problem about the nature of virtue, and is virtue teachable? Can it be passed on? Is it something that can be disseminated in the society? Can a whole society be virtuous if there are enough virtuous models in the society? And what Aristotle was doing in his account of the nature of virtue was to say, the person of practical wisdom, phronesis, this ability to see what the right thing to do is, what the middle path is in a given situation, is the person either to be or to emulate. And if you strive to be such a person, or if you successfully emulate such a person, then you are educating yourself, refining yourself as an ethical individual, and eventually you will succeed, and you will have this quality of succeeding, which he called eudaimonia, which quite literally means as if being looked after by a good angel, eudaimon. Although Aristotle didn't believe in angels, good or bad, but it was just the idea of it, that your life would be really worth living, really flourishing and full of achievement, and would be pleasing to live because you would be living wisely, living according to practical wisdom. Now, of course, everybody criticizes Aristotle on the grounds that the philosophy of the middle way is a very middle-aged, middle-class, middle-brow, rather sort of plodding, bourgeois kind of morality. Some burg, by the way, classical Athens, I suppose. It would not be a bad thing to be a bourgeois in classical Athens. But there is a point in that, isn't there, that criticism about it being too middle of the road. Because what about all the extremes of passion and despair and delight and creativity and wonder? Don't you want the extreme sometimes? Isn't it the case that the Epicureans, even the Epicureans, who in pursuing pleasure and fleeing pain said that all the normal things that you think are pleasing, like drinking and having lots of girlfriends or boyfriends or something, actually carry the seeds of pain. And the true pleasure is discussing philosophy under a tree on a warm day with some bread and water. Even they sometimes had a party, because they recognized that if you were going to, be continent, that you must be continent even in your continence. So they had the sort of Greek version of hogmanay, and had a good time, let their hair down and could express themselves in that way. And that's something that the Aristotelian position seems not to allow. Aristotle even went to the lengths of describing how the man of practical wisdom might walk, that is, with a slow and measured pace, So you see. But all this is an endeavor to picture a person and a place, a person and a society, which would really work, which would really have this character of being eudaimonic, of being flourishing and worth being in, satisfying to be in, which would be a good place to exist in. And so they're all strivings for the healthy society, and they're all of them premised on the idea of this analogy between the individual and the society. Because for Aristotle, when he wrote the Nicomachean Ethics, he described it as a preface, a prelude to his writings on the politics, on the nature of the polis. Because the polis, he said, is the theatre in which the good actor plays his part. You can't have somebody living a good life, a life really worth living, a life of flourishing and achievement and satisfaction, unless it is lived in the right kind of setting. So again, the relationship between the individual and the civil community is an intimate one, an internal relation. So there are lots and lots and lots of rich ideas here. Now we fast forward 2,500 years and see if we can apply some of these ideas to our thinking about the relationship between individual health and civil community. And I think the ideas that are worth taking out of it are primarily these two. First, one notices something very interesting about the classical conception of ethics. We now, today, in our contemporary debates, especially when there's some moral panic in our society over in vitro fertilization or stem cell research or abortion or whatever it might be, tend to think in terms of something slightly narrower than ethics. We tend to think in terms of morality. This is a distinction between ethics and morality, which has been well drawn by a couple of interesting recent thinkers, one contemporary still, Alasdair MacIntyre and Bernard Williams. We've pointed out that when we think about morality, we think about a fairly narrowly conceived set of considerations about our interpersonal relations and our responsibilities and obligations to one another, quite rightly so. But there is a broader matter too, which is not just about some aspects of our relationships, but about what sort of people we are, how we live our lives, and what kinds of choices we make in general. And to give you an example of the contrast, it would, on this view in which ethics is a more inclusive notion, be an ethical matter what colour you paint the front door of your house, but not, of course, a moral matter. It would be an ethical matter because it would express something about your ethos, about the kind of person you are and the kind of life you live. It would therefore say something of a much more general or inclusive nature about who you are and what you do and what you're like and what choices you make in your life beyond those considerations of your responsibility for your consideration and concern for other people. Now, ethics is what Aristotle and Plato meant. That's what they were talking about. They were talking about the whole business of being a person and being a person in a community. Not just about some aspects of it. Not just about the, you know, being faithful to your spouse and not telling fibs and what have you. I've always been delighted, by the way, in the fact that in the Church of Scotland it's regarded as a sin to tell an untimely truth. I always like that little refinement on these moral matters. Because it's not just about that. Okay? It's just not about morality, but about this whole business of who you are and what you do. And so when you go back and you look, as we've just been doing, at these ideas in classical antiquity, we talk about ethics and we talk about the ethical individual in the good society, we notice that when they talk about the analogy between the individual and the good society, they really mean it, because they're talking about something which takes the whole of the individual, every aspect of the individual's life, into account. And that makes it, gives us pause for thought, doesn't it? Because if we think now, if we somebody were to say now, it's a moral matter what you do about your health individually. It's a moral matter whether you smoke or drink to excess or have too much fat in your diet or don't take enough exercise and so on. If we said that, that would seem very odd. It would seem a strikingly odd thing to say. If you said that to a contemporary moral philosopher, footnote, somebody who's paid a salary all his or her life long to philosophize morally or immorally, as the case might be, end footnote. I mean, sorry, just to get back in that footnote. It's a terrific thought, that, isn't it? You know, if you think about all the great philosophers of the past, did some philosophy and then went on and did something useful, whereas nowadays it's a different world. End of footnote. So now, if you said to such an individual, surely it's a moral matter whether or not you smoke or have a high-fat diet or don't take any exercise. He or she would respond, no, it isn't. It's a prudential matter. You know, and it's purely hypothetical. Imperative lies behind it. If you want to be healthy, then don't smoke, or as the case might be, do smoke. But remember back in the 1950s, doctors said, you know, on television with their cigarettes, used to say, if you'll keep colds away, you know, have a cigarette every day. So if you want to be healthy, then dot, 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 you do this or don't do that. But that's an entirely prudential matter, and it depends upon what you want. I mean, you can either, you know, live fast and be happy and have an intense life and die early, or you can seem to have a tremendously long life by never enjoying yourself and so on. But these are just prudential matters, not moral ones. But of course they are ethical ones in the ancient sense. Do you smoke? Do you take exercise? Do you, you know, what do you eat? Well, these are questions that to an ancient Greek philosopher would have seemed to be centrally ethical questions. Because they're about your ethos, they're about what sort of person you are, what kind of life you live, and what it feels like to live your life. I mean, there's nothing prescriptive about this, at least yet, because we haven't yet decided whether it's an ethically desirable or undesirable thing to smoke or be fat or not to exercise. But the point I'm making just is that it's an ethical matter, whichever way around you think of it. But it's not a moral matter. So one thing that we should do when we look back at this early model, this beginning of the debate about the good life and the good society, is to take from it this idea of ethics as something very inclusive, and to think, therefore, in terms of ethos, individual ethos, and, if we're going to work the analogy that the ancient philosophers worked, the civil community ethos. And just to you know, not to tease the point, I mean, just to make the point very plain, think of this. Think of a civil community, or just a community, in which it is perfectly all right to smoke and not to exercise. I mean, go back to the 1950s or 60s. Remember what it was like to be in the cinema with the air thick with smoke, everybody smoking, you know, all the smoke steaming up from cigarettes. In those days, people didn't go jogging, did they? Very much, I mean, unless you were an athlete or a rugby player or something like that. They wouldn't dream about it. You could catch the bus or drive from home to the cinema with your packet of fags in your pocket and then back home again, have another fag. And the ethos permitted that. It was perfectly all right. It was perfectly acceptable. Now, in a restaurant, you know, somebody lights up. Well, sorry, it doesn't even have to be a restaurant. I must tell you a funny story, but a true one. Just a couple of years ago, on a commuter train in London, with a number of people sitting in it, reading their newspapers and so on, a young couple made love. And everybody studiously read their newspapers and so on. And then the young couple lit up. And everybody in the coach said, "This is a non-smoking coach." Which suggests that, you know, they had their priorities right anyway. there you see the ethos was, this is not a place that people smoke. We don't accept that here. We don't want you to do that. And this happens sometimes in restaurants as well. You know, somebody lights up, especially as it might be a cigar or something, and people at the surrounding tables all straighten up and tut-tut and give military looks and what have you. And I even heard somebody once lean over to a smoker and say, "When people smoke near me, I start to sneeze. And when I start to sneeze, I'm going to sneeze on your food because you're blowing your smoke on my food," and so on. Whereupon the person immediately stubbed out a cigarette. But what's interesting about that is that it's a question of ethos, of how this place, this space is going to be, what's acceptable in it. It was once completely acceptable for people to smoke anywhere, any public space. Now it's getting less so. We even now have a law which tells us that we can't smoke in public spaces. And that reflects, that follows upon a quite dramatic shift of ethos. So this idea, that an analogy between the ethos of the individual and the ethos of the community is a pretty direct one. The idea of what's acceptable, the idea of the prevailing attitude, the attitude that dictates how people behave or respond in the community space, the space of the community. So one thing that one immediately thinks is thinking about trying to change the statistics on individual health and on the health profile of a community. One thing that one thinks is, what is the ethos of the community? What's acceptable and what isn't? What's the prevailing attitude? Now, if the prevailing attitude is such that it permits, maybe even encourages, or at very least tolerates kinds of behavior which are inimical to individual health and therefore to the overall health profile, then the first task has to be to change the ethos, to challenge it, to attack it, to work hard at getting people to see things differently, to have a different attitude to what's acceptable and right. One could deduce many, many examples of the way that changes, quite dramatic changes in attitude, have made changes in certain sections of communities or in certain sort of sub-communities. For example, if you go to the rather delightful little town of La Jolla, just north of Los Angeles in California, you see people in very, very expensive designer tracksuits and very, very expensive running shoes mincing up and down the seafront on a Sunday morning, taking their exercise. This has become a kind of, you know, a sort of a fashion statement and a social event, rather like the promenade in the Bois de Boulogne in the 19th century or something, that you know, people mince up and down saying hi to one another like that in the inimitable Californian way. But this is something that people do because it's a social occasion. And you might see friends, and if you weren't there, people would be rather anxious. They'd bring you up and say, "Why weren't you jogging?" They don't really run, actually. They have this sort of Californian mince. But the idea of it is a quite extraordinary idea, because it means that the community ethos is such that people exercise, that people quite consciously do a whole set of things. They buy exercise clothes and they buy training shoes. Unfortunately, they then drive down to the seafront. But at least you see a big shift of attitude. You can also see as a slightly different example, but it's actually quite a telling example in a way. In the gym, now I go to the gym under instruction from my wife to do so. So there I am in the gym sweating away. And I can tell you with infallibility who among us are heterosexual and who among us aren't in the gym. Because the ones who aren't are beautifully sculpted, very, very fit and athletic looking and very manly. They've got bulging muscles and they wear tremendously sort of tight vests and all the rest of it. And the ones who are all panting and sweating and on their all fours and not quite, you know, wouldn't really quite do as a Greek statue, or all the heterosexual ones. Now, why is this so? It's because there is an ethos in the gay community in London of being very, very fit and healthy looking and sort of beautifully sculpted and having wonderfully defined muscles and so on, in a certain section of the gay community there, which makes them behave in a certain way. They wouldn't dream of not going to the gym. They wouldn't dream of turning up with their entrails hanging over their belt buckle. And therefore, they behave in a way which is concordant with that ethos. It's a jolly good ethos. And this just says, these are just ways of dramatizing by picking on certain populations which express a change of attitude that entails a change of behavior. And the change of behavior becomes the thing that expresses and embodies that attitude, that ethos. So the great lesson that one learns there is that to get the change in behavior, which will have the knock-on effect in health profile, you've got to get the change in attitude. But how do you get that change of attitude? How do you shift the ethos in a community or in a sub-community so that you bring about that desired effect? Well, this is the second point, the second lesson that one adduces from the classical experience. That is that you generate and you sustain the conversation in the civil community that will bring about that change of attitude. The conversation in question is important to the civil community in all sorts of ways. Obviously, not just in connection with health, but it is, if successful, will have as great an impact on individual and community health as it will have on all sorts of other things. Now, what's meant by this idea, this rather vague conception of the conversation that a civil community has with itself? Well, it's a very, very rich and broad idea, in fact. All societies of any level of development exist precisely because there's a conversation going on in that society. You know, from a Stone Age village in the middle of Africa to a sophisticated world city like London and New York or Glasgow, there is something going on, a cultural life, artistic endeavor, creation, publication of books, criticism in the newspapers, drama in the theaters, television. And I mean, one doesn't have to be highbrow about this. Culture is a very general thing. It speaks to and appeals to many different constituencies. But a soap opera on television does what a Jane Austen novel does for the same or a different kind of readership by commenting on the human condition and reflecting, mirroring aspects of one's own experience and providing insights that one might never have in one's own person into other lives and ways, educating our insights into other possibilities, human possibilities, helping us to be flies on the wall, glimpsing into lives that are very remote from our own. And then if we're attentive and reflective and responsive readers or viewers or theatre-goers or whatever, maybe helping us to tolerate choices and attitudes which are not our own, which are different from our own. Of course, one has to remember that tolerance has its limits. In just the same way as one mustn't be so open-minded that one's brains fall out, so one has to recognize that if you tolerate the intolerable, it's going to be self-defeating in the end. But nevertheless, the idea of a very plural society rubbing along with itself demands that there should be mutual understanding and tolerance and making of space for other people to have their choices exercised as well. And that's something that we have to learn how to do. And if you only had the example of your own empirical experience, your own family, your own immediate circle, then even though on that basis you became a very good and insightful and understanding person, nevertheless, the opportunity to think and respond even more broadly wouldn't be there without the narrative arts, without theatre, and so on. So all those things, theatre, literature, newspapers, television, all those things are all of them voices in the conversation. They're all parts of the conversation. And we all take part in the conversation when we read a newspaper or switch on the television or go to the theatre. And so we're always discussing things among ourselves. Many, many, many different voices, admittedly. Many competing voices, admittedly. But then it's up to each individual, each group, to take the best from what they're hearing and to set it to work. Now, part of that conversation, that a community has with itself can be about ways of living, things that are worth doing. Think of this. When you go to look at the sociological profile of people who attend night classes and extramural classes in London, you find an astonishingly high proportion of Europeans, and middle Europa, you know, people from Austria and Germany and Poland and places like that. A very high proportion of them, of those classes, despite the fact that the population in London as a whole of such people is very much smaller than the proportion of those people in those classes. Why? Well, because going to evening classes, going to the concert, going to the opera, is a natural sort of thing to do in the kind of communities that those people very often come from. If you go to a concert in Vienna or Prague or Berlin or somewhere like that, you notice families with small children. My mind wouldn't do it, but they do in those spaces, listening with great attention to the music and enjoyment and obvious intelligence. But because it's something that people do there, it's part of the ethos, it's part of the way they behave. Part of their conversation with themselves includes, quite naturally, as a very natural reflex, did you hear that performance of Beethoven's 7th last week, and you know, what did you think of it, and so on, and they're very knowledgeable and insightful. We, in the Anglo-Saxon world, and in the English-speaking world, that's the UK and the United States of America, there's a tendency for high culture like that to be something that people do when they're sort of dressed up for it. You know, you put on your mental bow tie and you go to an art gallery, and then you've been to the art gallery, and usually, of course, because you don't go often enough, you stay too long, and then you don't enjoy it, you don't remember the pictures and things like that. I haven't learned that an art gallery is a place you go to for 20 minutes to look at two pictures, or whatever. And that difference of ethos, it's a different conversation which is going on, a conversation about what sorts of things you do and are worth doing, and that make a difference to you. So here, the second idea, therefore, is the idea that one should try to introduce into the conversation those elements that will become constitutive of the ethos that arises from it. If you're trying to change the attitude, change the ethos, then you've got to change the conversation, or you've got to introduce something into the conversation that will bring about that change. So the way a civil community talks to itself and the kinds of things it talks about are going to be central to the way, ultimately, it behaves. I'm putting in mind of another, this time not a classical, but an early or late classical model here. Plutarch, the writer of the Lives, also, as you know, wrote a whole series of moral essays. And one of them was called The Dinner of the Seven Wise Men. And in it, he describes two of the guests at this dinner going to the dinner and talking to one another about the duties of a guest. And they say, well, we all know what it's like to be a host. You know, you've got to have the food ready and the wine and enough plates and some serving girls and all that kind of thing. So you know what the host has to do. But what must the guest do? What's the guest's duty? And they conclude that the guest's duty is to be a good conversationalist. That's somebody who is informed, who reads, who thinks and reflects, who has things to offer in conversation, and who is a good listener and an intelligent listener, who can pick up on what somebody else says and respond to it and encourage further contributions from that other person, to be a good conversationalist. Now, what does it take to prepare yourself to be a good guest at the Feast of Life? They ask one another. Well, not what the Sybarites wanted. You know, the Sybarites in southern Italy, they wanted their dinner invitations a year in advance so they could think what to wear. But so these two wise men said to one another, it takes much longer than a year to be a good guest at dinner. It takes a lifetime of reading and thinking and preparing to be a party to the conversation at the great Feast of Life. Now, that's a beautiful idea, but also it's a powerful suggestion for what a civil community should think about itself. I use the example of these middle Europeans who go to evening classes and lectures and worthy events and concerts and so on, because for them, the idea that education stops at 18 or 16 or 21 or something like that would be anathema. A whole life is an opportunity for education. I'm very fond of saying, I say to my students, and I repeat myself often in essays and things, that a human life is less than 1,000 months long. And for a third of those months, you're asleep. So, you know, the opportunities that you have really to get on with life. I'll never forget once driving back to London from Oxford, thinking to myself, God, I've never read Smollett. And I tried to work out, you know, how much time I had left, little books I had to write and things I had to do and sleep and have a bath and so on. You know, was I ever going to be able to read Smollett? I said to my wife when I got home, God, I've never read Smollett. And I, you know, when am I going to find the time? And she came back the next day with a volume of Smollett. And in the bath that night, I began to read it. And I thought, oh, hooray, I don't have to read Smollett. You know, I chucked it out of the box. And then a friend of mine said to me, oh, you've made a terrible mistake. Smollett's very funny. You have to go, oh, God, you know, I'm going to find Smollett. So it's actually the pressure of the fact that Time's winged chariot is, you know, galloping so close behind one that there's little, so little time to fill up every pulse of one's life with good things to do. But the idea that, a middle European intellectual type seems to premise, and not even to think is disputable, is that that's what you do. That's how you live. You educate yourself and you feed like a bee on the flower on the best things that life has to offer all the time in order to live richly and flourishingly and reflectively. So that idea of you know, getting into the conversation, the idea that's how you live, that's how you think, that's what you do, that's what your attitude is vital to getting the conversation round to the right kind of subject, which is, what is your ethos? How do you live? What kind of person are you? Are you the kind of person who, and then you can ask some very germane questions about how a person thinks of themselves physically as well as psychologically and intellectually. And when you get that conversation going in such a way that it changes the ethos, then you get what you find in La Jolla, or what you find in New York where there's no smoking in public places any longer, or what you find in the gym. You get people behaving in ways that are consistent with this new outlook, this different attitude, this ethos that they've adopted. Now, I would have thought that it's a commonplace, but again, to quote, just for safety's sake, Ludwig Wittgenstein for the second time, okay, it's really worth reminding oneself of those facts that lie so close under our noses that we no longer see them. That unless you change people's attitudes to their own lives and what they are and what it's good to do and be, you're not going to change their behavior. And it's very hard to change behavior and to change attitudes. And therefore, the people that you have to target in the conversation have to be the right groups. Obviously, younger people, obviously school-age people, people in secondary school, but also people who are role models, people who are influential in a society. People who, if they do something new or dramatic, I mean, look at David Beckham and hairstyles. I mean, there's a connection of influence that could be exploited in other ways, perhaps, if one could get those people to begin talking in the conversation about what would alter the ethos, then the ethos really might begin to shift. So it's you know, it's like asking, you know, if you're doing a fundraising, and we all have a horrible experience of trying to raise funds for some worthy cause, and you think, are you going to ask George Soros for some money? No, don't ask George Soros. Ask the person who advises George Soros. Find the right person to talk to. Find the right people to involve in the conversation, and then you've got a much better chance of changing the ethos that will change the behavior. And so that's another lesson that one might learn from this debate that was started by the ancient Greeks. So here my idea is this. The two things that we could connect, put into connection with one another, are the idea of the sort of conversation that a civil community has with itself about what's best, what's good, the best kind of structure, organization for that community, and the best kind of life in it, and the sort of life that's well worth having in that context. Put that idea, that notion, interconnection with the idea of an individual's health. And then one notices one final concluding thing, that it's not just a matter of cardiovascular disease in that individual, or preventing lung cancer in that individual, or changing that individual's diet and exercise habits and so on. It's not just that. But the idea of health, if one looks at the etymology of the term familiarly, means wholeness or integratedness. The idea of physical health and mental health not really separable from one another in any clean or quick way. I mean, we do tend to compartmentalize them, and there are many sane people who've got heart trouble and many mad people who've got healthy hearts and so on. But nevertheless, the idea of thinking well and feeling well and being well is obviously a very intimate one. And the Greeks saw that too, that idea of the healthy mind and the healthy body. Again, something so familiar and so obvious, so close under our noses that we forget it, should remind us now that the effort to make people feel involved and valued, and to make them aware, to make them want to read, to help them to be educated, to help them to challenge them to be reflective, that any of those things, if they rubbed off on anybody, could only be an opening of an opportunity for them to be healthier people in that sense of more integrated and wholer in their mental and physical health. So what one's inviting people to do by involving them in the conversation, which we hope will change the ethos and therefore the behavior, is to make them, each of them individually, more integrated, a sense of the sort of wholeness of being, which is an aspect, a very important central aspect of the life well worth living. And there, of course, is all sorts of ways. I wind up now with just a couple of thoughts about how one does this, challenging individuals to come into the conversation. One way is suggested by Albert Camus. In a philosophical discussion, one must always remember the French, because they're in different. Albert Camus, in his essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, says that the great question in philosophy is, should I or should I not commit suicide? Because if the answer is no, it's because there's a reason to go on living. There's something worth doing and worth being. There are aims and purposes and goals which are worth achieving. There's a reason to be alive. Now, if you stopped somebody in the street and you said, why haven't you committed suicide? They don't call a policeman or an ambulance or something like that. They're prepared to, go along with the Camus enterprise here. Say, why haven't you committed suicide? I say, well, I've got responsibilities. I've got, three bands, and I'm trying to get promotion at my job and blah, blah, blah. So you say to them, well, so there are things worth doing and worth being in your life. Is that so? Yes. Aims, goals. I want something. There's something I want to achieve. Here I am. I'm in the world, and I want to move from the place I'm in to some other place, or I'm enjoying myself or something. And then you could always say, as a supplementary, then why are you smoking? Or why are you not taking more exercise or something? Because these are facts about what you are and what you're doing, which have a chance of interfering with the plans that you've got or the goals that you've got. I mean, that's rather a simplistic example, but you see the point I'm making, trying to alert them to the fact that if they don't want to commit suicide, if they don't want to commit suicide full stop, then why commit suicide slowly by smoking or not taking exercise or whatever it might be? But what you're trying to get them to see is that there is a bigger picture of which the things that they value is only a part, and that therefore they ought to value certain other things as ancillary to these values. That if life is worthwhile, then the whole of your life has got to be worthwhile. That kind of idea. So there isn't any question, for me at any rate, that looking back at the source of our thinking about the good life and the good society has a great deal to tell us now, if only in providing a kind of compass setting about where to go in trying to think about very intractable problems like changing behavior in connection with health in a community like the community here in Southwest Scotland. And that there is much to learn from looking at the lessons, looking at the implications that those early models suggest to us. Thanks very much.